not even gnaw absent-mindedly at her wrists or toes. They left the door to the cottage open, so that from time to time they could peer out from the bed to check on the child, who, in the glare of a sunny day, would not be able to focus her eyes to see in the house shadows, and who, anyway, never turned to look. Turtleheart was unbearably beautiful. Melina dragon-snaked with him, covered him with her mouth, poured him in her hands, heated and cooled and shaped his luminosity. He filled her emptiness. They were washed and dressed, with supper mostly made, when the donkey brayed a half-mile down the lake. Melina blushed. Turtleheart was back at the pipe, blowing again. Elphaba turned and looked in the direction of the donkey's serrated statement. Her lips, which always looked almost black against the new apple color of her skin, twisted tight, chewed against each other. She bit her lower lip as if thinking, but she did not bleed. She had learned to manage the teeth somewhat, through trial and error. She put her hand on the shining disk. The glass circlet caught the last blue of the sky, until it looked like a magic mirror showing nothing but silver cold water within. Geographies of the Seen and the Unseen. All the way from Stonespar End, where Frex met her coach, Nanny complained. Lumbago, weak kidneys, fallen arches, aching gums, sore haunches. Frex wanted to say, "And how about your swollen ego?" Though he had been out of circulation for a while, he knew such a remark would be rude. Nanny flounced and petted herself, clinging determinedly to her seat until they arrived at the lodge near Rush Margins. Melina greeted Frex with affecting shyness. "My breastplate, my backbone," she murmured. She was slender after a hard winter, her cheekbones more prominent. Her skin looked scoured as if by an artist's scratch-brush, but she had always had the look of an etching in the flesh. She was usually bold with her kisses, and he found her reticence alarming, until he realized there was a stranger in the shadows. Then, after introductions, Nanny and Melina fussed to get a meal on the table, and Frex put out some oats for the sorry nag who had to pull the carriage. When this was done, he went to sit in the spring evening light and to meet his daughter again. Elphaba was cautious around him. He found in his pouch a trinket he'd whittled for her, a little sparrow with a cunning beak and upraised wings. "Look, Fabula," he whispered. Melina hated the derivative, so he used it. It was his and Elphaba's private bond, the father-daughter pact against the world. "Look what I found in the forest, a little maplewood bird." The child took the thing in her hands. She touched it softly and put its head in her mouth. Frex steeled himself to hear the inevitable splintering, and to hold back his sigh of disappointment. But Elphaba did not bite. She sucked the head and looked at it again. Wet, it had greater life. "You like it," Frex said. She nodded and began to feel its wings. Now that she was distracted, Frex could draw her between his knees. He nuzzled his crinkly bearded chin into her hair. She smelled like soap and wood smoke, and the char on toast, a good healthy smell, and he closed his eyes. It was good to be home. He had spent the winter in an abandoned shepherd's hut on the windward slope of Griffin's Head, praying and fasting, moving deeper inside and then further outside himself. And why not? At home, he had felt the scorn of the people of the whole claustrophobic valley of Ealeswater. They had connected the Time Dragon's slanderous story of a corrupt minister with the arrival of a deformed child. They had drawn their own conclusions. They avoided his chapel services. So a sort of hermit's life, at least in small intervals, had seemed both penance and preparation for something else, something next, but what? He knew this life wasn't what Melina had originally expected, marrying him. With his bloodlines, Frex had looked primed for an elevation to proctor, or even, eventually, bishop. He had imagined the happiness Melina would have as a society dame, presiding over feast-day dinners and charity balls and episcopal teas. Instead, he could see her in the firelight, grating a last limp winter carrot onto a pan of fish. Here she wasted away, a partner in a difficult marriage, on a cold, shadowy lakeshore. Frex had a notion that she wasn't sorry to see him go off from time to time, so that she could be glad to see him come back. As he ruminated, his beard tickled Elphaba's neck, and she snapped the wings off her wooden sparrow. She sucked on it like a whistle. Twisting away from him, she ran to a glass lens hanging from the projecting eave and swatted at it. "Don't! You'll break that," said her father. "She cannot to break that," the traveler, the quaddling, came from the sink, where he had been washing up. "She just turned her toy into a cripple," Frex said, pointing at the ruined birdling. "She is herself pleased at the half-things," Turtleheart said. "I think the little girl to play with the broken pieces better." Frex didn't quite get it, but nodded. He knew that months away from the human voice made him clumsy at first. The boy from the inn, who had climbed Griffin's head to deliver Nanny's request to be picked up at Stone's Bar End, had obviously thought Frex a wild man, grunting and unkempt. Frex had had to quote a little of the Ossiad to indicate some sort of humanity. "Land of green abandon, land of endless leaf." It was all that would come to him. "Why can't she break it?" asked Frex.
"Because I do not to make it to be broken," answered Turtleheart.
But he smiled at Frex, not aggressively. And Elphaba wandered around with the shiny glass as if it were a toy, catching shadows, reflections, lights on its imperfect surface, almost as if she were playing.
"Where are you going?" asked Frex, just as Turtleheart was saying, "Where are you from?"
"I'm a Munchkinlander," said Frex.
"I to think all Munchkins to be shorter than I or you."
"The peasants, the farmers, yes," Frex said, "but anyone with bloodlines worth tracing married into height somewhere along the way. And you? You're from Quadling country?"
"Yes," said the Quadling.
His reddish hair had been washed and was drying into an airy nimbus. Frex was glad to see Melina so generous as to offer a passerby water to bathe in. Perhaps she was adjusting to country life after all, because Mercy, a quaddling, ranked about as low on the social ladder as it was possible to get and still be human.
"But I, too, understand," said the quaddling. "Uvel's is a small world. Until I to leave, I am not to know of hills, one beyond the other, and from the spiny backbones a world so wide around, the blurry far away to hurt my eyes, for I cannot to make it seen. Please, sir, to describe the world you know."
Frex picked up a stick. In the soil, he drew an egg on its side. "What they taught me in lessons," he said, "inside the circle is Oz. Make an X." He did so through the oval. "And, roughly speaking, you have a pie in four sections. The top is Gilliken, full of cities and universities and theaters, civilized life, they say, and industry. He moved clockwise. East is Munchkin Land, where we are now. Farmland, the breadbasket of Oz, except down in the mountainous south. These strokes in the district of Wend Hardings are the hills you're climbing. He bumped and squiggled. Directly south of the center of Oz is Quadling Country. Badlands, I'm told, marshy, useless, infested with bugs and feverish airs. Turtleheart looked puzzled at this, but nodded. Then west, what they call Winky Country. Don't know much about that, except it's dry and unpopulated. And around, said Turtleheart. Sandstone deserts north and west, Fleckstone Desert east and south. They used to say the desert sands were deadly poison. That's just standard propaganda. Keeps invaders from Ev and Quox from trying to get in. Munchkin Land is rich and desirable farming territory, and Gilliken's not bad either. In the Glickus up here, he scratched lines in the northeast on the border between Gilliken and Munchkin Land, are the emerald mines and the famous Glickus canals. I gather there's a dispute whether the Glickus is Munchkinlander or Gillikenese, but I have no opinion on that. Turtleheart moved his hands over the drawing in the dirt, flexing his palms as if he were reading the map from above. But here, he said, what is here? Frex wondered if he meant the air above Oz. The realm of the unnamed god, he said. The other land? Are you a unionist?
Turtleheart is glassblower, said Turtleheart.
I mean religiously.
Turtleheart bowed his head and didn't meet Frex's eye. Turtleheart is not to know what name to call this.
I don't know about quadlings, said Frex, warming to a possible convert. But Gillikenese and Munchkinlanders are largely unionist, since Lurlinist paganism went out. For centuries, there have been unionist shrines and chapels all over Oz. Are there none in Quadling Country?
Turtleheart does not to recognize what is this, he said.
And now respectable unionists are going in droves over to the pleasure faith, said Frex. Snorting, or even TikTokism, which hardly even qualifies as a religion. To the ignorant, everything is spectacle these days. The ancient unionist monks and monts knew their place in the universe, acknowledging the life source too sublime to be named. And now we sniff up the skirts of every musty magician who comes along. Hedonists, anarchists, solipsists, individual freedom and amusement is all. As if sorcery had any moral component. Charms, alley magic, industrial strength, sound and light displays, fake shape-changers, charlatans, nabobs of necromancy, chemical and herbal wisdoms, humbug hedonists, selling their bog recipes and crone aphorisms and schoolboy spells. It makes me sick.
Turtleheart said, "Shall Turtleheart to bring you water? Shall Turtleheart to lie you down?"
He put fingers soft as calfskin on the side of Frex's neck. Frex shivered and realized he had been shouting. Nanny and Melina were standing in the doorway with the pan of fish, silent.
"It's a figure of speech. I'm not sick," he said. But he was touched at the concern the foreigner had shown.
"I think we'll eat."
And they did.
Elphaba ignored her food, except to prod the eyes out of the baked fish and to try to fit them onto her wingless bird. Nanny grumbled good-naturedly about the wind off the lake, her chills, her backbone, her digestion. Her gas was apparent from more than a few feet away, and Frex moved, as discreetly as possible, to be upwind. He found himself sitting next to the Quadling on the bench.
"So is all that clear to you?"
Frex pointed a fork at the map of Oz.
"Is Emerald City to beware?"
said the Quadling, fishbones poking out from between his lips.
"Dead center," Frex said.
"And there is Ozma," said Turtleheart.
"Ozma, the ordained queen of Oz, or so they say," Frex said, "though the unnamed god must be ruler of all in our hearts."
"How can unnamed creature to rule?" began Turtleheart.
"No theology at dinner," sang out Melina. "That's a house rule dating from the start of our marriage, Turtleheart, and we obey it.
Besides, I still harbor a devotion to Lurline." Nanny made a face in Frex's direction.
"Old folks like me are allowed to. Do you know about Lurline, stranger?"
Turtleheart shook his head.
"If we have no theology, then we surely have no errant pagan nonsense," began Frex. But Nanny, being a guest, and invoking a touch of deafness when it suited her, plowed on.
"Lurline is the fairy queen who flew over the sandy wastes and spotted the green and lovely land of Oz below. She left her daughter Ozma to rule the country in her absence, and she promised to return to Oz in its darkest hour."
"Ha!" said Frex.
"No haws at me," Nanny sniffed. "I'm as entitled to my beliefs as you are, Frex Spar the Godly. At least they don't get me into trouble as yours do."
"Nanny, govern your temper," said Melina, enjoying this.
"It's rubbish," said Frex.
"Ozma rules in the Emerald City, and anyone who's seen her, or paintings of her, knows that she's from Gillikinese stock. She's got the same broad band of forehead, the slightly gapped front teeth, the frenzy of curling blonde hair, the quick shifts of mood, usually into anger. All characteristic of Gillikinese peoples. You've seen her, Melina. Tell him."
"Oh, she is elegant in her way," Melina admitted.
"The daughter of a fairy queen?" said Turtleheart.
"More nonsense," said Frex.
"Not nonsense," snapped Nanny.
"They think she bears herself again and again like a phoenix," said Frex. "Ha and double ha. There have been 300 years of very different Ozmas. Ozma the Mendacious was a dedicated Mont, who lowered rulings in a bucket down from the topmost chamber in a cloister tower. She was as mad as a bung beetle. Ozma the Warrior conquered the Glickus, at least for a time, and commandeered the emeralds with which to decorate the Emerald City. Ozma the Librarian did nothing but read genealogies for her whole life long. Then there was Ozma the Scarcely Beloved, who kept pet ermines. She overtaxed the farmers to begin the road system of yellow brick that they're still struggling to complete, and much luck to them, I say."
"Who is Ozma now?" asked Turtleheart.
"Actually," said Melina, "I had the pleasure to meet the last Ozma at a social season in the Emerald City. My grandfather, the eminent Throp, had a townhouse. The winter I was 15, I was brought out into society there. She was Ozma the Bilious because of a bad stomach. She was the size of a Lake Narwhal, but she dressed beautifully. I saw her with her husband, Pastorius, at the Oz Festival of Song and Sentiment."
"She is no longer the queen?" asked Turtleheart, confused.
"She died in an unfortunate accident involving some rat poison," said Frex.
"Died?" said Nanny. "Or her spirit moved next into her child, Ozma Tipitarius."
"The current Ozma is just about the age of Elphaba," said Melina. "So her father, Pastorius, is the Ozma regent. The good man will rule until Ozma Tipitarius is old enough to take the throne."
Turtleheart shook his head.
Frex was annoyed because they had spent so much time talking about the worldly ruler and ignored the eternal realm, and Nanny lapsed into a bout of indigestion for which they all were very sorry, olfactorily speaking. Anyway, even being irritated, Frex was glad to be home. Because of the beauty of Melina, she was almost glowing tonight as the sun left the sky, and because of the surprise of Turtleheart, smiling and unself-conscious next to him. Maybe because of Turtleheart's religious emptiness, which Frex found challenging and appealing, almost tempting.
"Then there's the dragon beneath Oz, in a hidden cavern," Nanny was saying to Turtleheart. "The dragon who has dreamt the world, and who will burn it in flames when he awakes."
"Shut up that superstitious codswallop," shouted Frex.
Elphaba, on all fours, advanced on the uneven planks of the flooring. She bared her teeth, as if she knew what a dragon was, as if she were pretending, and roared. Her green skin made her more persuasive, as if she were a dragon child. She roared again.
"Oh, sweetheart, don't," said Frex.
And she peed on the floor, and sniffed her urine with satisfaction and disgust. Child's Play. One afternoon, toward the end of summer, Nanny said, "There's a beast abroad. I've seen it at dusk several times, lurking about in the ferns. What sorts of creatures are native to these hills, anyway?" "You don't find anything larger than a gopher," said Melina. They were at the side of the brook, working at laundry. The small spring wetness had long since ceased, and the drought had clamped its hand down again. The stream was only a thin trickle. Elphaba, who would not come near the water, was stripping a wild pear tree of its stunted crop. She clung to the trunk with her hands and outturned feet, and threw her head around, catching the sour fruit with her teeth, and then spitting seeds and stem on the ground.
"This is larger than a gopher," said Nanny. "Trust me. Have you bears?" "It could have been a bear cub, though it moved mighty fast."
"No bears. There's the rumor of rock tigers on the fell top, but they tell me not a single one has been sighted in ages, and rock tigers are notoriously skittish and shy. They don't come near human dwellings."
"A wolf, then? Are there wolves?"
Nanny let the sheet droop in the water.
"It could have been a wolf."
"Nanny, you think you're in the desert. Wend Hardings is desolate, I agree, but it's a tame barrenness for all that. You're alarming me with your wolf and your tiger talk." Elphaba, who would not speak yet, made a low growl in the pocket of her throat.
"I don't like it," said Nanny. "Let's finish up and dry these things back at the house. Enough is enough. Besides, I have other things I want to say to you. Let's give the child to Turtleheart and let's go off somewhere." She shuddered. "Somewhere safe."
"What you have to say, you can say within earshot of Elphaba," said Melina. "You know she doesn't understand a word."
"You confuse not speaking with not listening," said Nanny. "I think she understands plenty."
"Look, she's smearing fruit on her neck like a cologne."
"Like a war paint, you mean?"
"Oh, dear Nanny, stop being such a goose and scrub those sheets harder. They're filthy."
"I need hardly ask whose sweat and leakage this is."
"Oh, you... No, you needn't ask, but don't start moralizing at me."
"But you know Frex is bound to notice sooner or later. These energetic afternoon naps you take... Well, you always had an eye for the fellow with a decent helping of sausage and hard-boiled eggs."
"Nanny, come. This is none of your affair."
"More's the pity," said Nanny, sighing. "Isn't aging a cruel hoax? I'd trade my hard-won pearls of wisdom for a good romp with Uncle Flagpole any day."
Melina flipped a handful of water in Nanny's face to shut her up. The older woman blinked, and she said,
"Well, it's your garden. Plant there what you choose and reap what you may.
What I want to talk about is the child, anyway. The girl was now squatting behind the pear tree, eyes narrowed at something in the distance. She looked, thought Melina, like a sphinx, like a stone beast. A fly even landed on her face and walked across the bridge of her nose, and the child didn't flinch or squirm. Then, suddenly, she leaped and pounced, a naked green kitten after an invisible butterfly. What about her? Melina, she needs to get used to other children. She'll start talking a little bit if she sees that other chicks are talking. Talking among children is an overrated concept. Don't be glib. You know she needs to get used to people other than us. She's not going to have an easy time of it anyhow, unless she sheds her greeny skin as she grows up. She needs the habits of conversation. Look, I give her chores to do. I warble nursery rhymes at her. Melina, why doesn't she respond like other children? She's boring. Some children just are. She ought to have other pups to play with. They would infect her with a sense of fun. Frankly, Frex doesn't expect a child of his to be interested in fun, said Melina. Fun is counted for overmuch in this world, Nanny. I agree with him on that. So your dragon-snaking with Turtle Heart is what, devotional exercises? I said don't be catty, please. Melina focused on the toweling, beating it with annoyance. Nanny would go on about this. She was up to something, and Nanny had hit the nail on the head. There crept Turtle Heart into the cool shadows of the cottage when Melina was tired from a morning's work in the vegetable garden. He covered her with a sense of holiness, and it was more than her undergarments that would drop away from her when they tumbled, panting, onto the bedclothes. She would lose her sense of shame. She knew this did not follow conventional reason. Nevertheless, should a tribunal of Unionist ministers call her to court for adultery, she would tell the truth. Somehow, Turtle Heart had saved her and restored her sense of grace, of hope in the world. Her belief in the goodness of things had been dashed into bits when little green Elphaba crawled into being. The child was extravagant punishment for a sin so minor she didn't even know if she had committed it. It was not the sex that saved her, though the sex was mighty vigorous, even frightening. It was that Turtle Heart didn't blush when Frex showed up, that he didn't shrink from beastly little Elphaba. He set up shop in the side yard, blowing glass and grinding it, as if life had brought him here just to redeem Melina. Wherever else he might have been heading had been forgotten. "Very well, you old interfering cow," said Melina. "For the sake of argument, what do you propose?" "We must take Elfie to Rush Margins and find some small children for her to play with." Melina sat back on her haunches. "But you have to be jesting," she cried. "Slow and deliberate as Elphaba is, at least she's unharmed here. I may not be able to summon much maternal warmth, but I feed her, Nanny, and I keep her from hurting herself. How cruel to inflict the outside world on her! A green child will be an open invitation for scorn and abuse, and children are wickeder than adults. They have no sense of restraint. We might as well go throw her in the lake, she's so terrified of." "No, no, no," said Nanny, putting her fat hands on her own knees. Her voice was thick with determination. "Now I am going to argue with you about this, Melina, until you give in. Time, in its wisdom, will bring you around to my way of thinking. Listen to me. Listen to me. You are only a pampered little rich girl who flitted about from music lessons to dance lessons with neighborhood children equally rich and stupid as you. Of course there's cruelty. but Elphaba must learn who she is, and she must face down cruelty early. And there will be less of it than you expect. Don't play Nanny Goddess with me. I won't have it. Nanny is not giving up, said Nanny, just as fiercely. I have a long-range view of your happiness as well as hers, and believe me, if you don't give her the weapons and armor with which she can defend herself against scorn, she'll make your life miserable as hers will be miserable. And the weapons and armor she'll learn from the dirty urchins of Rush Margins? Laughter, fun, teasing, smiling. Oh, please. I'm not above blackmailing you about this, Melina, said Nanny. I can wander into Rush Margins this afternoon and find where Frex is trying to hold his revival meeting and whisper a few words to him. While Frex is busy cranking up the religious ardor of Rush Margins' sluggards, would he be interested in knowing what his wife is up to with Turtle Heart? You are a miserable old fiend. You are a foul, unethical bully, cried Melina. Nanny grinned with pride. No later than tomorrow, she said. We'll go in tomorrow and get her life started. In the morning, a stiff, unforgiving wind galloped from the heights. It picked up old leaves and the remains of failed crops and kitchen gardens. Nanny pulled a shawl across her rounded shoulders and tugged a bonnet over her brow. Her eyes were full of marginal beasts. She kept turning to see a slinking cat thing or a vixen dissolve into clots of skeleton leaves and debris. Nanny found a blackthorn staff, as if to aid her over stones and ruts, but she hoped to be ready to wield it against some hungry beast. "The land is dry and cold," she observed, almost to herself. "And so little rain. Of course, the big beasts would be driven from the hills. Let's walk together. No running ahead, little green." They made their way in silence. Nanny, fearful, Melina angry at having to miss her afternoon dalliance, and Elphaba like a wind-up toy, one foot solidly in front of the other. The margins of the lake had receded, and some of the crude docks were now walkways over pebble and drying green rot, with the water pulled back beyond their reach. Gaunette's was a dark stone cottage with a roof of mouldering thatch. Because of a bad hip, Gaunette was no good at hauling the fishing nets or at kneeling over the wasting vegetable gardens. She had a mess of small children in various stages of undress, squalling and sulking and trotting around the dirty yard in a little pack. She looked up as the minister's family approached. "Good day, and you must be Gaunette," said Nanny brightly. She was pleased to open the gate and be safely inside the garden, even of this hovel. "Brother Frexbar told us we would find you here." "Sweet Lurline, what they say is true," said Gaunette, making a holy sign against Elphaba. "I thought it vicious lies, and here she is." The children had slowed to a walk. They were boys and girls, brown-faced and white, all of them filthy, all of them keen on something new. Though they kept walking, playing some game of endurance or make-believe, their eyes never left Elphaba. "You know this is Melina, of course you do, and I am their Nanny," said Nanny. "We're pleased to meet you, Gaunette." She slid a glance at Melina and bit her upper lip and nodded. "Very pleased, I'm sure," said Melina stonily. "And we need some advice, for you come well recommended," said Nanny. "The little girl has problems, and the best of our thinking just doesn't seem to bring forth any good ideas." Gaunette leaned forward, suspicious.
"The child is green," whispered Nanny confidentially. "You may not have noticed, being attracted by her charm and warmth. Of course, we know the good people of Rush Margins wouldn't let a thing like that bother them. But because she is green, she is shy. Look at her. Little frightened spring turtle. We need to draw her out, make her happier, and we don't know how."
"She's green, all right," said Gaunet. "No wonder useless brother Frexbar retired from his preaching for so long."
She threw back her head and laughed raucously, unkindly.
"And he's only now had the nerve to take it up again. Well, that's balls, if ever I heard it."
"Brother Frexbar," interrupted Melina coldly, "reminds us of the scriptures. No one knows the color of a soul." "Gaunet, he suggested I remind you of that very text."
"Did he now?"
mumbled Gaunet, chastised.
"Well, then, what do you want with me?"
"Let her play, let her learn, let her come here and be minded by you. You know more than we do," said Nanny. "The cunning old cow," thought Melina. "She is trying that rarest of strategies, telling the truth and making it sound plausible." They sat down.
"I don't know if they'd take to her," said Gaunet, holding out a while. "And you know my hip doesn't let me hop up and stop them when they get going."
"Let's see. And of course there'd be some payment, some cash." "Melina fully agrees," said Nanny. The barren vegetable plot had caught her attention. This was poverty. Nanny gave Elphaba a push. "Well, go on in, child, and see what's what." The girl didn't budge, didn't blink. The children came near to her. There were 5 boys and 2 girls. "What an ugly pug," said one of the older boys. He touched Elphaba on the shoulder. "Play nicely now," said Melina, about to leap up, but Nanny kept her hand out to say, "Stay down."
"Tag. Let's tag," said the boy. "Who's the green fly?" "Not it! Not it!"
the other children shrieked, and rushed in to brush Elphaba with their hands, then raced away. She stood for a minute, unsure, her own hands down and clenched, and then she ran a few steps and stopped.
"That's the way. Healthful exercise," said Nanny, nodding. "Gaunet, you're a genius." "I know my chicks," said Gaunet. "Don't say I don't."
Herd-like, the children rushed in again, tapping and darting away, but the girl would not chase them. So they neared her once more.
"Is it true you got a quaddling muck frog staying with you, too?" said Gaunet. "Is it true he only eats grass and dung?"
"I beg your pardon," cried Melina.
"That's what they say, is it true?" said Gaunet.
"He's a fine man."
"But he's a quaddling."
"Well, yes."
"Don't bring him around here, then. They spread the plague," said Gaunet.
"They spread no such thing," snapped Melina.
"No throwing, Elfie dear," called Nanny. "I'm only saying what I hear. They say at night that quaddlings fall asleep and their souls climb out through their mouths and go abroad."
"Stupid people say a lot of stupid things." Melina was curt and too loud. "I have never seen his soul climb out of his mouth while he was sleeping, and I've had plenty of opportunity—"
"Darling, no rocks," shrilled Nanny. "None of the other children have rocks."
"Now they do," observed Gaunet. "He is the most sensitive person I've ever met," said Melina.
"Sensitive isn't much use to a fishwife," said Gaunet. "How about to a minister and a minister's wife?"
"Now there's blood. How vexing," said Nanny. Children, let Elfie up so I can wipe that cut. And I didn't bring a rag. Gornet?
Bleeding is good for them, makes them less hungry, said Gornet.
I rate sensitive a good sight higher than stupid, said Melina, seething.
No biting, said Gornet
to one of the little boys, and then, seeing Elphaba open her mouth to retaliate, raised herself to her feet, bad hip or no, and screamed,
No biting, for the love of mercy!
Aren't children divine? Said Nanny. Darkness Abroad. Every second or third day, Nanny took Elphaba by the hand and waddled the shadowy road to Rush Margins. There Elphaba mingled with the greasy children under the eyes of sullen Gornet. Frex had moved out again. Was it confidence or desperation? He was scaring miserable hamlets with his frenzied beard and his collected opinions on faith. Gone for 8, 10 days at a time. Melina practiced piano arpeggios on a tuneless mock keyboard Frex had carved for her to perfect scale. Turtleheart seemed to wilt and parch as autumn came on. Their afternoons of dalliance began to lose the heat of urgency and developed in warmth. Melina had always appreciated the attentions of Frex and been attentive to him, but somehow his body had not been as supple as Turtleheart's. She drifted off to sleep with Turtleheart's mouth on one of her nipples and his hands, his big hands, roaming like sentient pets. She imagined that Turtleheart divided his body when her eyes were closed. His mouth roamed, his cock rose and nudged and leaned. His breath was somewhere other than his mouth, hissing elegantly into her ear, wordlessly. His arms were like stirrups. Still, she didn't know him, not the way she knew Frex. She could not see through him as she could most people. She put this down to his majestic bearing. But Nanny, ever watchful, remarked one evening that it was just that his ways were the ways of a quadling, and Melina had never even acknowledged that he came from a different culture than she did. Culture. What's culture? Melina said lazily. People are people. Don't you remember your nursery rhymes? Nanny put aside her sewing, with relief, and recited, Boys study, girls know. That's the way that lessons go. Boys learn, girls forget. That's the way of lessons yet. Gillikinese are sharp as knives. Munchkinlanders lead corny lives. Glickens beat their ugly wives. Winkies swarm in sticky hives. But the quadlings, oh, the quadlings, slimy, stupid, cursed godlings, eat their young and bury their old a day before their bodies get cold. Give me an apple and I'll say it again. What do you know of him? Nanny asked. Is he married? Why did he leave Lower Slime Pit, or wherever he comes from? Naturally, it's not my place to ask such personal questions.
Since when did you ever know your place, or keep it either?
When Nanny leaves her place, believe me, you'll know, said Nanny. One evening in early autumn, for fun, they built up a fire in the yard. Frex was home and good-humored, and Nanny was thinking of heading back to Colwyn Grounds, which made Melina good-humored, too. Turtleheart put together a supper, a distasteful goulash of small sour new apples and cheese and bacon. Frex was feeling expansive. The effect of that blasted tick-tock contrivance, the clock of the time dragon, had been wearing off at last, thank the unnamed god, and the graceless poor had been turning out to hear Frex harangue them. A 2-week mission at Three Dead Trees had been a success. Frex had been rewarded with a small wallet of brass coins and barter tokens, and the glow of devotion or even lust on the face of more than one penitent.
"Perhaps our time here is limited," said Frex, sighing with contentment and clasping his arms behind his head. The typical male response to happiness, thought Melina, to predict its demise. Her husband went on.
"Perhaps the road from Rush Margins leads us on to higher things, Melina. Grander stations in life."
"Oh, please," she said. "My family rose from humble beginnings for 9 generations to produce me with my ankles in the mud out here in the middle of nowhere. I don't believe in higher things."
"I mean the lofty ambitions of the spirit. I don't mean to storm the Emerald City and become personal confessor to the Ozma Regent."
"Why not put yourself forward to be confessor to Ozma Tipitarius?" Nanny asked. She could see herself rising in courtly Emerald City society, if Frex had such a position.
"So what if the royal baby is only, what, 2 years old, 3? So we have government by a male regent again. It's only for a limited engagement, like most male encounters. You're young still. She'll grow up. You'll be well-placed to influence policy."
"I don't care about ministering to anyone in court, not even an Ozma the fanatically devout." Frex lit a sallowwood pipe.
"My mission is to the downtrodden and humble.
Goodness should to travel to Quaddling Country," said Turtleheart. "Downtrodden there."
Turtleheart didn't often speak of his past, and Melina remembered Nanny's jibe about her lack of curiosity. She waved the pipe smoke away and said,
"Why did you leave Ovals, anyway?"
"Horrors," he said.
Elphaba, who had been hoping for ants to crawl across the grinding stone so she could mash them with a rock, looked up across the shallow basin of the stone. The others waited for Turtleheart to go on. Melina's heart lifted uneasily. She had a sudden premonition of things changing right here, this very evening, this most splendid gentle night. Things going awry just when they had managed to settle down.
"What sort of horrors?" said Frex.
"I feel a chill. I'll get a shawl," said Melina.
"Or minister to Pastorius, the Ozma regent. Why not, Frex?" Nanny said. "I'm sure with Melina's family connections you could twist an invitation."
"Horrors," said Elphaba.
It was her first word, and it was greeted with silence. Even the moon, a lambent bowl among the trees, seemed to pause.
"Horrors?"
Elphaba said again, looking around. Though her mouth was serious, her eyes glowed. She had realized her own accomplishment. She was nearly 2 years old. The big, sharp teeth in her mouth could not keep her words locked inside her any more.
"Horrors," she tried in a whisper. "Horrors."
"Come to Nanny, darling. Come sit on my lap and hush for a while." She obeyed, but sat forward, apart from Nanny's cushiony bosom, allowing Nanny's arms to ring around her waist, but no contact more than that. She stared at Turtleheart and waited. And Turtleheart said in an awed voice,
"Turtleheart is thinking the child to speak for the first time."
"Yes," said Frex, exhaling a ring of smoke. "And she's asking about the horrors. Unless you don't care to tell us."
"Turtleheart to say little. Turtleheart to work in glass, and to leave words for the goodness and the lady and the nanny. And now for the girl."
"Say a little, though, since you brought it up."
Melina shivered. She hadn't gone for the shawl. She could not move.
She was heavy as stone.
"Workers from the Emerald City and other places, they to come to Quadling country. They to look and taste and sample the air, the water, the soil. They to plan the highway. Quadlings to know this is wasted time and wasted effort. They do not to listen to Quadling voices. Quadlings aren't road engineers, I suspect," said Frex evenly. "The country is delicate," said Turtleheart. "In ovals, the houses to float between trees. Crops to grow on small platforms hooked by ropes. Boys to dive in shallow water for vegetable pearls. Too many trees, and there is not enough light for crops and health. Too few trees, and the water rises and roots of plants floating on top cannot to stretch to soil. Quadling country is poor country, but beauty rich. It only to support life by careful planning and cooperation. So resistance to the yellow brick road is only part of the story. Quadlings cannot to convince road builders who want to build up dikes of mud and stone and to cut Quadling country in pieces. Quadlings to argue and to pray and to testify and cannot to win with words."
Frex held his pipe in his two hands and watched Turtleheart speak. Frex was drawn to him. Frex was always drawn to intensity.
"Quadlings consider to fight," said Turtleheart, "because they think this is only the start. When the builders to test soil and to sift water, they to learn of things Quadlings are smart forever. But Quadlings to keep still. Things, you know.
Turtleheart, to speak of rubies," he said with a great sigh. "Rubies under the water, red as pigeon blood. Engineers to say, red corundum in bands of crystalline limestone under swamp. Quadlings to say, the blood of Oz."
"Like the red glass you make?" said Melina.
"Ruby glass to come by adding gold chloride," said Turtleheart. "But Quadling country to sit atop real deposits of real rubies. And the news is sure to go to the Emerald City with the builders. What to follow is horror upon horror."
"How do you know?" snapped Melina.
"To look in glass," said Turtleheart, pointing to the roundel he had made as a toy for Elphaba, "is to see the future in blood and rubies."
"I don't believe in seeing the future. That smacks of the pleasure faith," said Frex fiercely. "The fatalism of the time dragon. Fa! No, the unnamed god has an unnamed history for us, and prophecy is merely guesswork and fear."
"Fear and guesswork is enough to make Turtleheart to leave Quadling country, then," said the Quadling glassblower, without apology. "Quadlings do not to call their religion a pleasure faith, but they to listen to signs and to watch for messages. As the water to run red with rubies, it will to run with the blood of Quadlings."
"Nonsense," Frex fussed, red himself. "They need a good talking to."
"Besides, isn't Pastorius a simpleton?" said Melina,
who alone of them could claim an informed opinion on the royal house.
"What will he do until Ozma is of age but ride the hunt and eat Munchkinlander pastries and fuck the odd housemaid on the side?"
"The danger is a foreigner," said Turtleheart, "not a homegrown king or queen. The old women and the shamans and the dying, they to see a stranger king,
cruel and mighty.
What is the Ozma Regent doing, planning roadworks into that godforsaken mire anyway? Melina asked.
Progress, said Frex. Same as the yellow brick road through Munchkin Land. Progress and control. The movement of troops, the regularization of taxes, military protection.
Protection from whom? Said Melina.
Ah, said Frex, always the important question.
Ah, said Turtleheart, almost in a whisper.
So where are you going? Said Frex. Not that you need leave here, of course. Melina loves having you around. We all do.
Horrors, said Elphaba. Hush now, said Nanny.
Lady is kind, and goodness is kind to Turtleheart, who did not mean to stay more than a day. Turtleheart was on his way to the Emerald City, and to get lost. Turtleheart to hope to beg audience with Ozma.
Ozma regent now, interjected Frex.
And to plead mercy for Quadling country, and to warn of brutal stranger.
Horrors! Said Elphaba, clapping her hands together in delight.
The child to remind Turtleheart of his duties, he said. To talk of it brings duties back out of the pain of the past, Turtleheart to forget. But when words are to speak in the air, actions must to follow.
Melina glared hatefully at Nanny, who had dropped the girl on the ground and begun to busy herself with collecting the supper dishes.
See what comes of prying and nosiness, Nanny, see? Just the dissolution of my only earthly happiness, that's all.
Melina turned her face from her horrid child, who seemed to be smiling, or was that wincing? She looked at her husband with despair.
Do something, Frex. Perhaps this is the higher ambition we seek, he was murmuring. We should travel to Quadling country, Melina. We should leave the luxury of Munchkin Land and try ourselves in the fire of a truly needy situation.
The luxury of Munchkin Land? Melina's voice was screechy.
When the unnamed god speaks through a lowly vessel, began Frex, gesturing at Turtleheart, who was looking desperate again. We can choose to hear, or we can choose to harden our hearts.
Well, hear this, then, said Melina. I'm pregnant, Frex. I can't travel. I can't move. And with a new infant to watch as well as Elphaba to raise, it's too much to suggest tramping around Mudland.
After the stillness had lost some of its steam, she continued.
Well, I didn't intend to tell you like this.
Congratulations, said Frex, coldly.
Horrors, said Elphaba to her mother. Horrors, horrors, horrors. That's enough thoughtless chatter for one night, said Nanny, taking charge. Melina, you will catch a chill sitting out here. Summer nights are turning colder again. Come inside and let's let that be that.
But Frex got himself up and went to kiss his wife. It was not clear to anyone whether he suspected that Turtleheart was the father, nor was it clear to Melina which one, her husband or her lover, was the father. She didn't actually care. She just didn't want Turtleheart to leave, and she hated him fiercely for being so suddenly riven with moral feeling for his miserable people. Frex and Turtleheart conversed in low voices that Melina could not make out. They sat by the fire with their heads low together, and Frex had his arm on Turtleheart's shaking shoulders.
Nanny readied Elphaba for bed, left her outside with the men, and came to sit on Melina's bed with a glass of hot milk on a tray and a small bowl of medicinal capsules.
"Well, I knew this was coming," said Nanny calmly. "Drink the milk, dear, and stop sniveling. You're behaving like a child again. How long have you known?"
"Oh, 6 weeks," said Melina. "I don't want milk, Nanny. I want my wine."
"You'll drink milk. No more wine till the baby's born. You want another disaster?"
"Drinking wine doesn't change the skin color of embryos," said Melina. "I may be a dolt, but I know that much about biology."
"It's bad for your frame of mind. Nothing more and nothing less. Drink the milk and swallow one of these capsules."
"What for?"
"I did what I told you I'd do," said Nanny in a conspiratorial voice. "Last fall I poked around the lower quarter of our fair capital on your behalf."
The young woman was suddenly engaged.
"Nanny, you didn't. How clever. Weren't you terrified?" "Of course I was. But Nanny loves you, however stupid you are. I found a store marked with the secret insignia of the alchemist's trade."
She wrinkled her nose in recollection of the smell of rotting ginger and cat piss.
"I sat down with a saucy-looking old biddy from Shiz, a crone named Yackle, and drank the tea and upended the cup so she could read the leaves. Yackle could barely see her own hand, much less read the future."
"A real professional," Melina said dryly.
"Your husband doesn't believe in predictions, so keep your voice down. Anyway, I explained about the greenness of your first child and the difficulty of knowing exactly why it had happened. 'We don't want a recurrence,' I said. So Yackle ground up some herbs and minerals and roasted it with oil of gamba and said some pagan prayers. And for all I know, she spit in it. I didn't watch too closely. But I paid for a 9-month supply, to be begun as soon as you're sure you've conceived. We're a month late, maybe, but this'll be better than nothing. I have supreme confidence in this woman, Melina, and you should, too."
"Why should I?" said Melina, swallowing the first of 9 capsules. It tasted like boiled marrow.
"Because Yackle predicted greatness for your children," said Nanny. "She said Elphaba will be more than you credit, and your second will follow suit. She said not to give up on your life. She said history waits to be written, and this family has a part in it."
"What does she say about my lover?"
"You are a pest," said Nanny. "She said to rest and not to worry. She gives her blessing. She is a filthy whore, but she knows what she's talking about."
Nanny didn't mention that Yackle was certain the next child would be a girl, too. There was too much chance Melina would try to abort her, and Yackle sounded quite sure that history belonged to 2 sisters, not a single girl.
"And you got home safely? Did anyone suspect?" "Who would suspect innocent old Nanny of trading in illegal substances in the lower quarter?" laughed Nanny. "I do my knitting and mind my own business. Now go to sleep, my love. Nix to the wine for the next few months, and stay the course with this medicine, and we'll have for you and Frex a decent, healthy child, which will provide no end of recovery for your marriage."
"My marriage is perfectly fine," said Melina, snuggling down under the covers. The capsule had a kick, but she didn't want Nanny to know.
"As long as we don't go wading off into the muddy sunset." "The sun sets in the west, not in the south," said Nanny soothingly. "It was a masterly stroke to bring up the pregnancy tonight, my dear. I wouldn't come to visit you if you went paddling off into Quadling country, by the way. I'm 50 years old this year, you know. There are some things Nanny is really too old to do."
"Well, nobody better go anywhere," said Melina, and began to fall asleep.
Nanny, pleased with herself, glanced out the window again as she prepared to retire. Frex and Turtleheart were still deep in conversation. Nanny was sharper than she let on. She had seen Turtleheart's face when he was remembering the threat to his people. It had opened like a hen's egg, and the truth had fluttered and wobbled out of it, just as naive as a yellow chick, and as fragile. No wonder Frex was sitting nearer to the beleaguered quadling than Nanny thought was altogether decent. But there seemed no end of oddity to this family.
"Send the girl in so I can put her down," she called from the window, partly to interrupt their intimacy.
Frex looked around. "She's in, isn't she?" Nanny glanced. The child was not given to hiding games, neither here nor with the brats in the village.
"No. Isn't she with you?"
The men turned and looked.
Nanny thought she saw a blur of movement in the blue shadows of the wild yew. She stood up and held on to the window ledge. "Well, find her. It's the prowling hour." "There's nothing here, Nanny."
"It's your overactive imagination," drawled Frex. But the men were up quickly and looking around.
"Melina, dear, don't sleep yet. Do you know where Elphaba is? Did you see her wander off?" said Nanny.
Melina struggled to lift herself to one elbow. She stared through her hair and her inebriation.
"What are you on about?"
she asked in a slur.
"Who is wandering off?"
"Elphaba," Nanny said.
"Come on, you better get up. Where could she be? Where could she be?"
She started to help Melina up, but it was happening too slowly, and Nanny's heart was beginning to beat fast. She fixed Melina's hands to the bedposts, saying,
"Now come on, Melina, this is not good."
And she reached for her blackthorn staff.
"Who?" said Melina. "Who's lost?"
The men were calling in the purple gloaming. "Fabula! Elphaba! Elfie! Little frog!" They circled out away from the yard, away from the dying embers of the dinner fire, peering and hitting at the lower branches of bushes.
"Little snake! Lizard girl, where are you?" "It's the thing! The thing has come down from the hills, whatever it is!" cried Nanny.
"There's no thing, you old fool," said Frex, but he leaped more and more vigorously from rock to rock behind the lodge, smacking branches aside. Turtleheart stood still, his hands out to the sky, as if trying to receive the faint light of the first stars into his palms.
"Is it Elphaba?"
called Melina from the door, finally focusing, and stepping forward in her nightgown.
"Is the child gone?"
"She's wandered off. She's been taken," said Nanny fiercely.
"These two idiots were flirting like schoolgirls, and the beast from the hills is abroad."
Melina called, her words mounting in pitch and terror.
"Elphaba! Elphaba! You listen to me! Come here this instant! Elphaba!"
The wind alone answered. "She is not far," said Turtleheart after a moment. In the deepening dark, he was almost invisible, while Melina in her white poplin glowed like an angel, as if lit from within.
"She is not far. She just is not here."
"What the devil do you mean?" Nanny said, weeping, "with your riddles and your games." Turtleheart turned. Frex had come back to him to throw an arm around him and hold him up, and Melina came forward to his other side. He sagged for a minute as if fainting. Melina cried out in fright. But Turtleheart straightened up and began to move forward, and they headed toward the lake.
"Not the lake, not that girl. She can't abide water, you know that," called Nanny.
But she was rushing forward now, using her staff to feel the ground ahead of her so she wouldn't stumble. "This is the end," thought Melina. Her brain was too foggy to think anything else, and she said it again and again, as if to prevent it from being true. "This is the beginning," thought Frex. "But of what?"
"She is not far. She is not here," said Turtleheart again.
"Punishment for your wicked ways, you two-faced hedonists," Nanny said. The ground sloped toward the still, receded margin of the lake. First at their feet, then at their waists, and higher, the beached dock rose, like a bridge to nowhere, ending in air. Beneath the dock, in the dry shadows, there were eyes.
"Oh, sweet Lurline," whispered Nanny.
Elphaba was sitting under the dock, with the looking-glass that Turtleheart had made. She held it in two hands, and stared at it with one eye closed. She peered, she squinted, her open eye was distant and hollow. "Reflection from the starlight off the water," thought Frex, hoped Frex, but he knew the bright, vacant eye was not lit by starlight.
"Horrors," murmured Elphaba.
Turtleheart tumbled to his knees.
"She sees him coming," he said thickly. "She sees him to come. He is to come from the air, is arriving. A balloon from the sky, the color of a bubble of blood. A huge crimson globe, a ruby globe, he falls from the sky. The regent is fallen. The house of Ozma is fallen. The clock was right. A minute to judgment."
He fell over, almost into Elphaba's small lap. She didn't seem to notice him. Behind her was a low growl. There was a beast, a fell-top tiger, or some strange hybrid of tiger and dragon, with glowing orangey eyes. Elphaba was sitting in its folded forearms, as if on a throne.
"Horrors,"
she said again, looking without binocular vision, staring at the glass in which her parents and Nanny could make out nothing but darkness.
"Horrors."
Galinda.
"Whittaker, Seneca, Wickersand turning, Red Sand, Dixie House, change at Dixie House for shiz. Stay aboard this coach for all points east. Tennekin, Brox Hall, and all destinations to Traum." The conductor paused to catch his breath. "Next stop, Whittaker, Whittaker next."
Galinda clutched her parcel of clothes to her breast. The old goat who sprawled on the seat across from her was missing the Whittaker stop. She was glad the trains made passengers sleepy. She didn't want to keep avoiding his eye. At the last minute before she was to board the train, her minder, Amma Clutch, had stepped on a rusty nail, and, terrified of the frozen face syndrome, had begged permission to go to the nearest surgery for medicines and calming spells.
"I can surely get myself to shiz alone," Galinda had said coldly. "Don't bother with me, Amma Clutch." And Amma Clutch hadn't.
Galinda hoped that Amma Clutch would suffer a little frozenness of jaw before being well enough to show up in shiz and chaperone Galinda through whatever was to come. Her own chin was set, she believed, to imply a worldly boredom with train travel. In fact, she had never been more than a day's carriage ride away from her family home in the little market town of Frotica. The railway line, laid down a decade ago, had meant that old dairy farms were being cut up for country estates for the merchants and manufacturers of shiz. But Galinda's family continued to prefer rural Gillikin, with its fox haunts,
its dripping dells, its secluded ancient pagan temples to Lurline. To them, Shiz was a distant urban threat, and even the convenience of rail transportation hadn't tempted them to risk all its complications, curiosities, and evil ways. Galinda didn't see the verdant world through the glass of the carriage. She saw her own reflection instead. She had the nearsightedness of youth. She reasoned that because she was beautiful, she was significant, though what she signified and to whom was not clear to her yet. The sway of her head made her creamy ringlets swing, catching the light, like so many jostling stacks of coins. Her lips were perfect, as pouted as an opening Maya flower, and colored as brilliantly red. Her green traveling gown with its inset panels of ochre musset suggested wealth, while the black shawl, draping just so about the shoulders, was a nod to her academic inclinations. She was, after all, on her way to Shiz because she was smart. But there was more than one way to be smart. She was 17. The whole town of Frotica had seen her off. The first girl from the Pertha Hills to be accepted at Shiz. She had written well in the entrance exams, a meditation on learning ethics from the natural world. Do flowers regret being plucked for a bouquet? Do the rains practice abstinence? Can animals really choose to be good? Or a moral philosophy of springtime? She had quoted excessively from the Aziad, and her rapturous prose had captivated the Board of Examiners. A 3-year fellowship to Craige Hall. It wasn't one of the better colleges. Those were still closed to female students, but it was Shiz University. Her companion in the compartment, waking up when the conductor came back through, stretched his heels as he yawned.
"Would you be so kind as to reach my ticket? It's in the overhead," he said.
Galinda stood and found the ticket, aware that the bearded old thing was eyeing her comely figure. "Here you are," she said, and he answered,
"Not to me, dearie, to the conductor. Without opposable thumbs, I have no hope of managing such a tiny piece of cardboard."
The conductor punched the ticket and said,
"You're the rare beast that can afford to travel first class." "Oh," said the goat, "I object to the term beast. But the laws still allow my traveling in first class, I presume." "Money's money," said the conductor, without ill will, punching Galinda's ticket and returning it to her. "No, money's not money," said the goat. "Not when my ticket cost double what the young lady's did. In this case, money is a visa. I happen to have it."
"Going up to Shiz, are you?" said the conductor to Galinda, ignoring the goat's remark.
"I can tell by that academic shawl."
"Oh, well, it's something to do," said Galinda. She didn't care to talk to conductors. But when he continued along down the carriage, Galinda found that she liked even less the baleful look that the goat was giving her.
"Do you expect to learn anything at Shiz?" he asked.
"I have already learned not to speak to strangers."
"Then I will introduce myself, and we will be strangers no longer. I am Dillamond."
"I am disinclined to know you."
"I am a fellow of Shiz University on the Faculty of Biological Arts."
"You are a shabby dresser, even for a goat," Galinda thought. "Money isn't everything." "Then I must overcome my natural shyness. My name is Galinda. I am of the Arduena clan on my mother's side."
Let me be the first to welcome you to Shiz, Glinda. This is your first year?
Please, it is Galinda. The proper old Gilliconese pronunciation, if you don't mind.
She could not bring herself to call him Sir. Not with that horrid goatee and the tatty waistcoat that looked cut from some public-house carpet.
I wonder what you think of the wizard's proposed bans on travel.
The goat's eyes were buttery and warm and frightening. Galinda had never heard of any bans. She said as much.
Dillamond, was it Dr. Dillamond,
explained in a conversational tone that the wizard had thoughts of restricting animal travel on public conveyances except in designated transports. Galinda replied that animals had always enjoyed separate services.
No, I am speaking of animals, said Dillamond. Those with a spirit.
Oh, those, said Galinda crudely. Well, I don't see the problem.
My, my, said Dillamond. Don't you indeed?
The goatee quivered. He was irritated. He began to hector her about animal rights. As things now stood, his own ancient mother couldn't afford to travel first class, and would have to ride in a pen when she wanted to visit him in Shiz. If the wizard's bans went through the Hall of Approval, as they were likely to do, the goat himself would be required by law to give up the privileges he had earned through years of study, training, and saving.
"Is that right for a creature with a spirit?" he said. "From here to there, there to here, in a pen?"
"I quite agree. Travel is so broadening," said Galinda.
They endured the rest of the trip, including the change across the platform at Dixie House, in a frosty silence. Seeing her fright at the size and bustle of the terminus at Shiz, Dillamond took pity and offered to engage a carriage to take her to Craige Hall. She followed him, looking as unmortified as she could manage. Her luggage came behind on the backs of a couple of porters.
Shiz! She tried not to gulp. Everyone hustling on business, laughing and hurrying and kissing, dodging carriages, while the buildings of Railway Square, brownstone and bluestone, and covered with vine and moss, steamed softly in the sunlight. The animals, and the animals! She had scarcely ever come across even the odd chicken squawking philosophically in Frotica. But here was a quartet of zebras at an outdoor café, dressed flashily in black and white satin stripes on the bias to their inborn design, and an elephant on its hind legs directing traffic, and a tiger dressed up in some sort of exotic religious garb, a kind of monk or mont or nun or something. Yes, yes, it was zebras and elephant and tiger, and she supposed goat. She would have to get used to enunciating the capital letters, or else she would show off her country origins. Mercifully, Dillamond found her a carriage with a human driver, and directed him to Craige Hall, and paid him in advance, for which Galinda had to come up with a weak smile of appreciation.
"Our paths will cross again," said Dillamond, gallantly, if curtly, as if putting forth a prophecy, and he disappeared as the carriage jolted forward.
Galinda sank back into the cushions. She began to be sorry that Amma Clutch had punctured her foot with a nail. Craige Hall was only 20 minutes from Railway Square. Behind its own bluestone walls, the complex was set with large watery glass windows in lancet formation. A tessellation of catterfoils and blind multifoils ran riot at the roofline.
The appreciation of architecture was Galinda's private passion, and she pored over the features she could identify, although the vines and flat moss fudged many of the finer details of the buildings. Too soon, she was whisked inside. The headmistress of Craige Hall, a fish-faced upper-class Gilliconese woman wearing a lot of cloisonné bangles, was greeting new arrivals in the atrium. The head eschewed the drabness of professional women's dress that Galinda had expected. Instead, the imposing woman was bedecked in a currant-colored gown with patterns of black jet swirling over the bodice like dynamic markings on sheet music.
"I am Madame Morrible," she said to Galinda. Her voice was basso profundo, her grip crippling, her posture military, her earrings like holiday tree ornaments. "Flourishes all around, and a quick cup of tea in the parlor. Then we'll assemble in the main hall and sort you out as to roomies."
The parlor was filled with pretty young women, all wearing green or blue, and trailing black shawls like exhausted shadows behind them. Galinda was glad for the natural advantages of her flaxen hair, and stood by a window so the light could dazzle itself off her curls. She hardly sipped the tea. In a side room, the attendant amos were serving themselves from a metal urn, and laughing and yakking already as if they were old friends from the same village. It was somewhat grotesque, all those dumpy women smiling at each other, making marketplace noise. Galinda hadn't read the fine print very closely. She hadn't realized there would be a need for roomies. Or perhaps had her parents paid extra so she could have a private room? And where would Alma Clutch stay? Looking about her, she could tell that some of these dollies came from families much better off than hers. The pearls and diamonds on them. Galinda was glad she had chosen a simple silver collar with metanite struts. There was something vulgar about traveling in jewels. As she realized this truth, she codified it into a saying. At the earliest perfect opportunity, she would bring it out as proof of her having opinions, and of having traveled. The overdressed traveler betrays more interest in being seen than in seeing, she murmured, trying it out, while the true traveler knows that the novel world about her serves as the most appropriate accessory. Good, very good. Madame Morrible counted heads, gripped a cup of tea, and shooed everyone into the main hall. There, Galinda learned that allowing Alma Clutch to go looking for a surgery had been a colossal mistake. Apparently all that chatter among Amas hadn't been frivolous and social. They had been instructed to sort out among them whose young lady would room with whose. The Amas had been relied upon to get to the nub of the matter more quickly than the students themselves. No one had spoken for Galinda. She had gone unrepresented. After the forgettable welcome remarks, as couple by couple the students and Amas left to locate their lodgings and settle in, Galinda found herself growing pale with embarrassment. Ama Clutch, the old fool, would have fixed her up nicely with someone just a notch or two above on the social ladder. Near enough that Galinda would suffer no shame, and above enough to make it worth the while of socializing. But now all the better young misses were linked together, diamond to diamond, emerald to emerald, for all she could tell. As the room began to empty, Galinda wondered if she shouldn't go up and interrupt Madame Morrible and explain the problem. Galinda was, after all, an Arduenna of the uplands, at least on one side. It was a hideous accident. Her eyes teared up. But she hadn't the nerve. She stayed perched on the edge of the fragile, stupid chair.
Except for her, all the center of the room had cleared out now, and the shyer, more useless girls were left around the edges in the shadows. Surrounded by an obstacle course of empty, gilded chairs, Galinda alone sat like an unclaimed valise.
"Now the rest of you are here without armors, I understand," said Madame Morrible, a bit sniffily. "Since we require chaperonage, I will assign each of you to one of the three dormitories for freshers, which sleep 15 girls each. There is no social stigma to the dormitory, I might add, none at all."
But she was lying, and not even convincingly. Galinda finally stood up.
"Please, Madame Morrible, there is a mistake. I am Galinda of the Arduenas. My ama took a nail in her foot on the voyage and was detained for a day or two. I am not in the dormitory class, you see."
"How sad for you," said Madame Morrible, smiling. "I'm sure your ama will be pleased to be a chaperone in, shall we say, the pink dormitory? Fourth floor on the right."
"No, no, she would not," interrupted Galinda quite bravely. "I am not here to sleep in a dormitory, pink or otherwise. You have misunderstood."
"I have not misunderstood, Miss Galinda," said Madame Morrible, growing even more fish-like as her eyes began to bulge. "There is accident. There is tardiness. There are decisions to be made. As you are not equipped, through your ama, to make your own decision, I am empowered to make it for you. Please, we are busy, and I must name the other girls who will join you in the pink dormitory."
"I would have a private word with you, madam," said Galinda in desperation. "For myself, dormitory partners or a single roomie, it is no matter, but I cannot recommend that you ask my ama to oversee other girls, for reasons I may not say in public." She was lying as fast as she could, and better than Madame Morrible, who seemed at least intrigued.
"You strike me as impertinent, Miss Galinda," she said mildly.
"I have not yet struck you, Madame Morrible." Galinda delivered the daring line with her sweetest smile. Madame Morrible chose to laugh, thank Lurline.
"A spark of spunk! You may come to my chambers this evening and tell me the story of your ama's shortcomings, as I should know them. But I will compromise with you, Miss Galinda. Unless you object, I will have to ask your ama to chaperone both you and another girl, one who comes without an ama. For you see, all the other students with amas are already paired off, and you are the odd one out."
"I am certain my ama could manage that, at least." Madame Morrible scanned the page of names and said,
"Very well. To join Miss Galinda of the Arduenas in a double room, shall I invite the Throp Third Descending of Nest Harding's Elphaba?"
No one stirred.
"Elphaba?"
said Madame Morrible again, adjusting her bangles and pressing two fingers at the bottom of her throat. The girl was in the back of the room, a pauper in a red dress with gaudy fretwork, and in clumpy old people's boots. At first, Galinda thought what she saw was some trick of the light, a reflection off the adjacent buildings covered in vines and flat moss. But as Elphaba moved forward, lugging her own carpet bags, it became obvious that she was green. A hatchet-faced girl with putrescent green skin and long, foreign-looking black hair.
"A Munchkinlander by birth, though with many childhood years spent in Quadling country," read Madame Morrible from her notes. "How fascinating for us all, Miss Elphaba. We shall look forward to hearing tales of exotic climes and times.
Miss Galinda and Miss Elphaba, here are your keys. You may take room 22 on the second floor."
She smiled broadly at Galinda as the girls came forward.
"Travel is so broadening," she intoned.
Galinda started, the curse of her own words lobbed back at her. She curtsied and fled. Elphaba, eyes on the floor, followed behind. By the time Amma Clutch arrived the next day, her foot bandaged to 3 times its natural size, Elphaba had already unpacked her few belongings. They hung rag-like on hooks in the cupboard, thin, shapeless shifts, shamed into a corner by the fulsome hoops and starched bustles and padded shoulders and cushioned elbows of Galinda's wardrobe.
"I am happy as cheese to be your Amma, too. Don't matter to me," said Amma Clutch, smiling broadly in Elphaba's direction, before Galinda had a chance to get Amma Clutch alone and demand that her minder refuse.
"Of course, my papa is paying you to be my Amma," said Galinda meaningfully, but Amma Clutch answered,
"Not as much as all that, ducky, not as much as all that. I can be making up my own mind."
"Amma," said Galinda, when Elphaba had left to use the mildewy facilities,
"Amma, are you blind? That Munchkinlander girl is green."
"Odd, isn't it? I thought all Munchkinlanders were tiny. She's a proper height, though. I guess they come in a variety of sizes."
"Oh, are you bothered by the green? Well, it might do you some good if you let it. If you let it. You affect worldly airs, Galinda, but you don't know the world yet. I think it's a lark. Why not? Why ever not?"
"It's not yours to organize my education, worldly or otherwise, Amma Clutch."
"No, my dear," said Amma Clutch. "You've made this mess all by your lonesome. I'm merely being of service."
So Galinda was stuck. Last night's brief interview with Madame Morrible had not provided any escape route either. Galinda had arrived promptly, in a dotted morpholine skirt, with lace bodice, a vision, as she'd said to herself, in nocturnal purples and midnight blues. Madame Morrible bade her enter the reception room, in which a small cluster of leather chairs and a settee were drawn up before an unnecessary fire. The head poured mint tea and offered crystallized ginger wrapped in pearl fruit leaves. She indicated a chair for Galinda, but herself stood by the mantelpiece, like a big game hunter. In the best tradition of the upper class savoring its luxuries, they sipped and nibbled in silence at first. This gave Galinda the chance to observe that Madame Morrible was fish-like not merely in countenance, but in dress. Her loose-fitting cream foxeal flowed like a huge airy bladder from the high frilled neckline to the knees, where it was tightly gathered and dropped straight to the floor, hugging the